Isaiah chapter 7.
In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not yet mount an attack against it. And when the house of David was told, Syria is in league with Ephraim, the heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. And the Lord said to Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Jashub, your son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the washer's field. Say to him, be careful, be quiet, do not fear, and do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands, at the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah. Because Syria with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has devised evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and terrify it, and let us conquer it for ourselves, and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, and it shall not come to pass, for the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. And within 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered from being a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz. As a sign of the Lord your God, ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be deep as Sheol or high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, and I will not put the Lord to the test. And he said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men that weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. The Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria. In that day the Lord will whistle for the fly that is at the end of the stream of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria, and they will all come and settle in the steep ravines and in the clefts of the rocks and on the thorn bushes and on all the pasture. In that day the Lord will shave with a razor that is hired beyond the river with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of his feet, and it will sweep away the beard also. In that day a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep, and because of the abundance of milk that they give, he will eat curds, for everyone who is left in the land will eat curds and honey. That day, every place where there used to be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver will become briars and thorns. With bow and arrows, a man will come there, for all the land will be briars and thorns. And as for all the hills that used to be hoed, with a hoe, you will not come there for fear of briars and thorns, but they will become a place where cattle are let loose and where sheep tread.
Isaiah chapter 7.
Many of you weren't here last week, which took a lot of preparation to get to this week in looking at the history of Israel and King Ahaz, which without it makes it difficult to understand this passage. I will touch on it in a little bit. But what I want to bring out first is a concept. I just want to get you thinking, because I'm going to probably challenge how you think about this prophecy of the virgin birth. There are two times in the book of Isaiah that God comes and says, ask me for a sign, and I will give it to you. Now, he does this in a couple other places. I think he does it with King Saul. But whenever God comes and invites us to ask him to give him a sign, the appropriate response is always to ask for a sign. So Ahaz's response of, no, I won't do that, is an improper response. But I want you to look at the other place where this happens, because I wonder if it doesn't tip us off to something. In the other place where this happens, God says to Hezekiah, Hezekiah is sick, and God says he's going to die, and he prays and sets his face towards the wall, and God sends Isaiah to him and says, tell Hezekiah that I've decided to give him 15 more years. Now, I don't know why you need a sign for this. If you get better and you don't die, isn't that a sign enough? Seems to me like it would be. But God then says to Hezekiah, and ask of a sign of me that my word will happen. But he says it in a very interesting way. He says, ask me either for the shadow to go up the 7 steps of Ahaz's, it's actually a time dial. It's like a sundial. Or ask it to go down the steps. Well, here's the deal. When the shadow goes up the steps, that's what happens every single day. The sun rises in the east, goes to the west, and the shadow goes up the steps every single day. Now, to ask the shadow to come down the steps, that would require the sun to stop and go backwards in the sky. Now, that's a pretty amazing sign. That would be a sign that would cause all kinds of problems if God was not in control of everything. But really, what I want you to see with this asking is this. Hezekiah may make a mistake here. He presumes that one is more miraculous than the other. He says, well, it wouldn't be anything for the shadow to go up the steps. So I ask that you bring the shadow back down the steps, which God does. But I want us to consider that question for a moment. Is it? Is it really more miraculous that God could stop the sun in the middle of the sky and take it backwards than it is that he brings it up every day and across the sky? Aren't both of these miraculous? No, we don't think of the one as miraculous. You know why? Because it happens all the time. But it is miraculous. And it seems to me that God is saying, look, I will give you a great sign. Here's a couple of options. You can have the shadow go up. Wait a minute, but that happens every day. Yeah, but I'm the one that does it. My word is true. And in fact, one of the things I said early on in my word is, that sun's going to rise every single day. And it's going to set there every day. I'm going to set the seasons. I'm going to bring the sun up and I'm going to take it down and you never have to worry about that. Because I am in control, and my word is true. Isn't that a great sign that God will keep his word, that the sun rises every morning and sets in the evening? Should be. And I will argue it's really no less miraculous. It's only miraculous in the sense that that's what we're not used to, and that's what nature necessarily doesn't function in that way. But nature functions in the way that it functions because God has ordained it and put it in place. So it's interesting. Now, stay with me. Don't get mad at me yet, because I'm gonna get there. But let me ask a simple question. Is it more miraculous that a virgin gives birth or that a woman gives birth? Is not the birth of a child a miraculous thing, no matter how it comes about? Is not the God giving life miraculous? Cannot both of those things be signs? In fact, in the chapter, we're going to see two, for sure, natural births of children that function as signs for God. Why? Guys, no woman has a child apart from the miraculous, life-giving power of God. The reason we think the virgin birth is so miraculous is not because, I'm not suggesting it's any less than so miraculous. What I'm saying is, I think sometimes we've lost sight that a natural birth is equally miraculous. It cannot happen apart from the miraculous power of God's life-giving work. And I think these two signs that God asks for, that he wants to give, there may be a connection that Hezekiah missed the fact that, yes, I'll do this super spectacular thing for you, but I do want you to recognize that the sun just rising and setting is pretty miraculous. And it should be a sufficient sign. It should be a sufficient sign. Now we come back to Isaiah, and this really can get tricky. So let me tell you why there's a problem. Because if I don't tell you the problem to begin with, you won't see why I'm working so hard to solve it. So let's look at the verse that creates the problem. In verse 14, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel." Is there any problem for God in a virgin giving birth to a child? There's no problem at all. Would it be miraculous? Sure it would. But guess what? If this was a young maiden in Israel, it would also be miraculous. So our problem here is not with a virgin giving birth. But the next verse is a problem. "He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good." What does that mean? Let's start with this part. Maybe we can explain a few of these things away. What does it mean that he'll eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good? It tells us that this child will be born under oppression. What? Curds and honey, that sounds good. Guys, the chapter explains it later on. When is it that a child will be fed on curds and honey? When all the vineyards are gone. When all the ground that is cultivated has been destroyed. When all that's left in the land is briars, and what do you get? You get cattle and sheep that can graze a little bit, and you can get a little bit of hunting. Some wild animals maybe, because that's all that's going to live there. Because all of that fertile ground, all of that bounty, all of that is gone. And why is it gone? Well, we know from the chapter why it's gone. Because this king, Tilgath-Pileser III, the king of Assyria, his empire has swept over Israel and Judah, right up to the neck, swept over them like a river out of its banks, and has brought oppression on them and destruction, and has taken people away as captives. He has destroyed their fields, he has destroyed their crops, and he's hauled people off, and Jerusalem is still there, but that's about it. That's up to the neck. The water's right up to the neck. That's Jerusalem. Its head is barely staying above the water. This tells us that this child that's going to be a sign is born under this kind of circumstance. And that's why he says he eats curds, because you can make cheese if you have a cow. Cows can graze. They'll still give milk. And you can eat the curds. And honey, there's still going to be bees. They still make honey. These are things that actually, these are the kinds of things that when you find yourself in absolute destitution, you're able to find this kind of food. "And this child, when he is young, he shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse evil and choose the good." When would that be? Well, we could only guess here, to be honest with you. But let's just throw a year out there, because another child's going to be born. I want to throw a different year out for that. I think a child starts understanding the difference between good and evil. Maybe not right and wrong, but good and evil. Probably a little bit later, 3, 4, maybe 5 years old. Now, I think a very young child can understand something that's bad or good in the sense of I shouldn't do this or not. But comprehend the ideas of good and evil. That child has got to be a little bit older. But here's the point. That child isn't going to be much more than 5 years old and probably a little bit less. What does it go on to say here? Here's our problem. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. Well, who are these two kings? Well, it's the king of Aram, Rezin, which is Syria, by the way. That's why sometimes I say Syria, or because Damascus is the capital of both of these places. And Israel, the northern kingdom, the capital being Samaria, the son of Remaliah. These two kings have aligned themselves against the king of Judah, and they want to take him down. And why is this? And replace him with the son of Tabeel. This is so important at the beginning to understand the passage, because what do they want to do? They want to bring to an end a promise of God. And what is that promise? That David will have a son that will sit on this throne forever. Ahaz is a horrible man. He may be the worst king between both nations. He does not worship God. In fact, he's the most religious king that's ever lived, probably. But unfortunately, it's because he will worship anything and everything except for Yahweh. He's a terrible man. He's a terrible king. But he is the son of David. And to replace him with Tabeel, well, what are they trying to do? They're trying to thwart the promise of God. And God says, that's not happening. In fact, you don't even have to really worry about these guys. You're going to have bigger worries than these two. And I'll get to them in a minute. But you're going to have way bigger worries than Syria or Aram and Damascus and Samaria and Ephraim trying to get rid of God's chosen family on this throne. You don't need to worry about them because you got bigger things to worry about. And the point here is that because God is not going to let that happen, he is not going to bring an end to this line. He refuses to. So he comes to Ahaz and he says, Ahaz, this is what I would like you to do, which Ahaz does not do. But it doesn't seem to matter because God says, well, I'm going to give you a sign anyway. Because this really isn't about whether or not you're going to be obedient to me. This is not really about whether you're faithful or not faithful. This is about my promise and my word and me keeping it. So he comes to Ahaz and he says, Ahaz, this is what I want you to do. I want you to do nothing. If you will just do nothing, I'll be happy with you. Do nothing. Yes. What is Ahaz doing at the time? He's out at the end of this place by the pool, the washer's pool. It's a very significant place. If they have just created it, in fact, and they've created it for the purpose of withstanding a siege. They have finally figured out a way to get water in Jerusalem from inside. So that when somebody lays siege against the city, they can't cut off their water supply and kill them all. So one of the things Ahaz is doing is he's planning. He is making plans. Plans for what? Plans to thwart an invasion by the son of Remaliah and Rezin. So he's taking into his own hands the means in which I'm going to stay alive and not let these guys defeat me. That's plan number one. He has plan number two. Plan number two is there's this king in Assyria, not Syria, Assyria, Tilgath-Pileser III, who is beginning the world's first empire. It is the world's first empire. And we'll come back to that because it's so crucial to the text. And his country is getting bigger and bigger as they take more and more lands and incorporate more and more forces into their army. And now their army is becoming massive. This massive army that begins, and just as the text tells us, it's like a river out of its banks. The river it's talking about there is the Euphrates. Nineveh sits right along the Euphrates River. That is where the capital is. And it's like this swelling of this army and this empire and this nation is like a river out of its banks, and we know what that looks like. We see it all the time on the news and down in Mississippi and New Orleans and in all those areas as the water floods across the land and destroys everything in its path. And Ahaz gets the idea, I'll write him a letter and see if he'll come and help me by defeating these two. But you see what Ahaz is not doing. He's not doing what God has asked him to do, which is really two things. One, don't do anything. And trust me. Don't do anything and trust me. Why he said don't do anything is because almost anything Ahaz can do here to stop this from coming is a way of trusting in something other than God. He wants him to do nothing and trust that God can actually keep his word and his promise to David that his son of David will sit on this throne. So don't you worry because somebody wants to replace you with somebody else. By the way, you need to know that this is the policy of the Assyrians. The Assyrians are going to come in, they're going to wipe you out, and the first thing they're going to do is they're going to take your king from the throne and kill him and his entire family, and then they're going to put their king on your throne, and then they're going to remove your people. If that doesn't work, which it usually didn't, then they're going to remove your people and put them in another faraway land and bring people from a faraway land and bring them into yours. Guys, all of the promises of God are at threat here. The land is at threat. The people, the nation are at threat. The promise of a king is at threat. All the promises are at threat, and it's just looming right there on the horizon with this king of Assyria, this first empire that's starting to spread. And God wants Ahaz, just don't do anything. Trust me, I can keep my word. But unfortunately, Ahaz does do something. He writes Tilgath-Pileser and says, would you come and help me? And Tilgath-Pileser comes and guess what? He helps him. He does exactly what Ahaz wants him to do. He wipes out Aram and Damascus, and he wipes out Ephraim and Samaria, or the northern kingdom in Samaria, and he takes those kings off their throne, and they're dead, and they're wiped out, and they've been removed. And then he turns his eye towards Jerusalem and says, well, I might as well have you too. And so he marches towards Jerusalem, and eventually, 65 years, he gets, before 65 years, he gets there. And we actually have to go way down the story, and we're back to that very person, Hezekiah, that has the other sign. Thank goodness Hezekiah did trust the Lord. Because that Assyrian army piled up around the walls of Jerusalem 185,000 strong. It's actually more than that. We know the number 185,000 because that's how many the Lord struck down in one day. And I think it's interesting that there are very few places in the Old Testament that a story in the Old Testament finds confirmation in extra-biblical historical records. This is the one place where it does. Now, it is not called the angel of the Lord, but we read that a huge force of Assyrian soldiers were struck with a plague, and in one day they were devastated and had to return home to Assyria. So God can take care of his people. But we come back to this passage. I just want you to see now what he does. God then comes to Ahaz and says, Ahaz, I know you're worried, I know you're frightened, you're thinking, how in the world, with this new development in the world of empires just flooding the nations and destroying them, how in the world is God going to keep his word? Now, Ahaz is not thinking that, but I do think there's a lot of faithful Israelites that are thinking that. How's he going to do this? And so God comes to Ahaz and says, look, I can do it. I'm God and I can handle it. Ask me for a sign. Anything you want, as big as you want, from Sheol to the heavens, from the east is to the west, you name it, whatever big sign you want, I'm willing to give it to you to prove to you that I can keep my word. And you know what he does? He says, no, I don't want to test the Lord. Because the truth is, Ahaz doesn't want to trust the Lord. Ahaz is not interested in worshiping the Lord. He doesn't want to align himself with Yahweh and then feel obligated to be obedient to him. And so then we learn that God responds and says, well, I'm going to give you a sign, or I'm going to give the house of David a sign anyway. Okay, I can't give it to you, so I'm going to give you this sign. And the sign will be this. The virgin will give birth to a son, will bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now we come back to our problem. But it appears that this sign and this child are going to be born relatively soon. In fact, by the time this child is 4 or 5, the point is, the king Tiglath-Pileser has come and wiped out Judah's enemies. That's what the text seems to imply. That's what a sign would be. Here is a child. This is going to happen. The virgin is going to give birth to a child. And before this child is 4 or 5 years old, your problems are going to be gone. That's what the text says. What's our problem then? I thought this prophecy was about Jesus. That's the first problem. Well, how long does Jesus live after this prophecy was given? 30 years. Well, they will be gone when he's 4 or 5 years old, but come on, guys, that's kind of cheating, isn't it? They've been gone for 730 years. Is that really the point that this text is making? Or that when we see that this kid is 4 or 5 years old, we'll look around and there won't be anybody? I don't think there was anybody when Jesus was born, and when he was 3 or 4 years old, people were looking around saying, wow, there's no son of Remaliah. There's no resin. They've been dead for 730 years. That doesn't make any sense. However, I do think there is a parallel. Because I do think that there is another king who is a lot like those two kings that is living in Jesus' day. And he too wants to destroy the people of God, and in particular, he wants to destroy what? The line of David. He doesn't want to put Tabeel on the throne. Who does he want to put on the throne? Himself and his descendant. And what is his name? Herod. And isn't it interesting? By the time Jesus is about 3 years old, Herod is what? He's dead. So we'll come back to that. But there is a connection. But first we need to see how the prophet is operating here. But Jesus wasn't born during this time. Now here's our second problem. Are we going to suggest that there was a child born in the 7th century from a virgin? The incarnation of Jesus is a very unique miracle. Am I really going to suggest that there was an earlier sign that a son that lived in 720 or 30 BC was born of a virgin like Jesus was? And if they were born of a virgin, what are we going to do with that? Because we know what we do with it with Jesus. This is part of our whole understanding that he is in fact God. There's a lot of theology around that virgin birth and the necessity for it. But it would be a real problem if there's some other child out there that's born of a virgin. I don't think so. I think in the original context, it means something like this. I'm not even sure it's talking about a particular individual. I think he is saying to Ahaz, you're worried that you are going to be destroyed, that the line of David is going to end, that the people of God are going to be swallowed up and destroyed. In fact, Ahaz, you're not worried enough about that, but there's a lot of people in Judah, a lot of people in Jerusalem that are worried about it. They are looking and they're seeing their world is changing, and they cannot imagine how they will survive in it. Consequently, they can't imagine how God's word and his promises to them is going to be fulfilled. And God comes to them and says, look it, the virgin will bear a son, and you will call him Emmanuel. Now, let me start with the you will call him Emmanuel. No matter who we identify as this son, there is no one actually called Emmanuel. Hezekiah, for example, has been identified as the son, that the idea of the virgin was the queen of, that Ahaz had. And that he would have a son, and his son's name would be Hezekiah, and Hezekiah would be a sign to Ahaz that the promise made to David would not be thwarted by these two kings or Tilgath-Pileser III. That Hezekiah becomes the sign that, nope, my promise to David is going to continue. So that's one idea. Here's the problem. Hezekiah wasn't called Emmanuel. You might say, well, we got that covered, at least Jesus was. Actually, he is not. The only time that word is connected to Jesus is when Matthew says he's in fulfillment of this verse that the virgin will give birth to a son and he will be called Emmanuel. But what is Jesus called? Jesus. His name is Jesus. And why is he named Jesus? We're told by Matthew. Because he will be a savior of his people from their sins. Jesus is Joshua. It means savior. In fact, there's actually no place in the New Testament where Jesus is named Emmanuel. Now, I will say this. There's a lot of places in the New Testament that says that when Jesus is there, God is there. God is with us. So it's lurking right behind him the whole time. But there's no place that says he will be called. He's named this. So let's put that aside for a moment and say, maybe this isn't so much about naming a child. Let's come back. The virgin will give birth to a son, and you will call him Emmanuel. I want to suggest this, and then I'm going to show you how I think Isaiah then can use it to say this is a prophecy of an actual virgin giving birth. I think what God is saying is, look it, you are worried that my word is not going to come true. Let's go back to the very first promise God makes to Abraham. What is it? You will have a son. And from this son, there will be a nation of people. And from that nation, all the nations of the earth, in fact, it says many nations will come from Abraham's son. And from that nation, though, of promised ones, all the nations will be blessed. But most importantly, and in that nation, a seed will eventually come that will bless all those nations. And we learn from Paul that that seed is, in fact, Jesus. So I want you to get this promise in your head. The promise to Abraham is, you're going to have a son. His name is Isaac. From Isaac is going to come a nation of people. And that nation is going to continue to exist. It may be shrunk down to a remnant, but it will always continue to exist. And why will it continue to exist? Because from that nation will come one son, whose name is Jesus, who will bless all the nations of the earth. This is God's promise. That's one promise. Now he comes to David. He makes another promise. David, you're a part of that nation. You too will have a son. And from you, a son will eventually come, and he will rule over this nation. Oh, by the way, David, I'm not going to tell you this, but people later on will figure it out. Your son and the son that was promised to Abraham that will bless all the nations, they're the same son. So consequently, this Jesus has to be born to fulfill two promises, one to Abraham to bless all the nations of the earth, and one to David to have a son that sits on his throne and rules over his people and his kingdom forever and ever. And we know the same person is the fulfillment of that. Guess what happens if Tabeel gets put on the throne of Judah and Tilgath-Pileser III comes and wipes out Judah and kills them all and takes, wipes out the entire line of David and takes the people and scatters them all over the place? What happens? The promises of God are in danger. So God comes and says to Israel, let me give you a sign that that will not happen. The virgin will give birth to a son. Now, virgin can be translated. It means virgin, no matter how it's translated. Young maiden. In other words, a young woman of marriageable age. She would be a virgin. She will have children. It doesn't necessarily mean she'll have it miraculously in the sense that she remains a virgin while she has the child. It can easily mean that she will have a child in a natural way. But Tom, how can that be a sign? How can it be a sign that an Israelite woman having a child in a natural way says to us that God is going to protect and save his line. Well, let's start with the article, the virgin. I don't know if it's talking about a specific Israelite woman. I think it's talking about, in a sense, the Israelite woman, which is a representative of all of them. So think of it this way. Ahaz, every time, or any of the rest of you guys, that in the 7th century BC, any of you guys who are worrying that God will not keep his word, every time an Israelite woman, young maiden, has a child, you will be reminded of this. God is with us. Why? Because every time a child is born, it is a reminder that God is keeping his word. You have to understand this. Every Israelite woman always was thinking in terms of, will my child be the Messiah? They all thought that way. Will my child be the Messiah? Every time an Israelite woman has a child, it is a reminder that God's keeping his promise that I'm bringing a seed. Now, if that is what's going on here, then we think, well, how then does that relate to Jesus? How then can Matthew come along and say, this is a prophecy that the virgin, Mary, will have a child? I still think it's there. I want to read a little bit farther and see other things that are going on here. So let's go back to chapter 7. That's the problem. We need a child that's... And so I think the point, the way this sign works in the context is, the women who have children in the next couple of years from when Isaiah pronounces this sign, what he's saying is every one of these children are reminders that God is with us and that before they reach an age of 4 or 5, these kings are gone. Okay, but that doesn't sound like it has anything to do with Jesus. Well, let's read a little bit farther. So as we go on, we see that the king of Assyria will come. The Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria. And in that day, the Lord will whistle for the fly, that's probably Pharaoh, that is at the end of the streams of Egypt, and for the bee, that is the king of Assyria, that is in the land of Assyria, and they will all come and settle in the steep ravines and in the clefts of the rocks and on the thorn bushes and on the pastures. These two great empires are going to start warring with each other, and guess what? You're the battleground. And you're just going to get beaten back and forth by these two. How in the world is God going to keep his promises to his people and his nation and a king on the throne? How can that even ever happen? And in that day, the Lord will shave with a razor that is hired beyond the river. That is Tilgath-Pileser III. He's the razor. What will he shave? Well, to put it simply, guys, and there is a euphemism here, the hair on the feet. There really isn't. It's not really a reference to the hair on the feet. This is Jews do this, we do this. They use things we call euphemisms because they don't want to say what they really want to say because it would not be polite in a culture, any culture. But all you really have to know is he's going to shave every last hair off your body. That's what this prophecy is saying. What does he mean by that? He's going to come and bring great and utter shame upon you. And it's going to be hard. And you're going to wonder what? Where's God's promises now? Where's God's promises now? We are a beaten people. We are filled with shame. We've been... Every bit of our hair is gone. And for a Jew, it's shame. The head, the beard in particular, everything is gone. I'm filled with shame. I'm oppressed by this king. I've lost my land. The land is no longer fruitful. Where are the promises of God? Where are they? And Isaiah is saying, every time you see an Israelite maiden give birth to a child, you should be reminded, Emmanuel, God is with us. Because the point of chapter 7, and in particular, the point of chapter 8, is that God is going to be with his people during this whole thing. Now, I want to stop again, because we got to take a historical sidestep, because we don't think about this. This is at a critical change point in world history, this story. Up to this point, you have many kingdoms and they kind of fight with one another. In actuality, it's similar to what we have today with lots of nations. But something has changed and the prophet sees it and God says, I'm behind it. It's no longer just a nation here or a nation there. It is empires. And this new form of government is going to last 1,000 or more years. Because the Assyrian is the first empire. It is followed immediately by the Babylonian Empire. And then by the Persian Empire. And then by the Greek Empire. And by the Roman Empire. For over 1,000 years. And there's no break in these empires. And God says, I'm going to do something. And in the process of this, you're going to find that things will change for you. But you know what will not change for you? Emmanuel. That's not going to change. But God, we've lost our land. But God, there's no king on our throne. But God, our temple's been destroyed. But God, we've been thrown in far distant lands. Your promises are gone. God has one answer, Emmanuel. God is with you everywhere. Haggai, when he's building the temple and there's nothing but a foundation there, he reminds the people when they look at it and they say, oh, this is nothing like the former glory of the old temple. He says, that's okay. God is with us. His spirit is in our midst. When Ezekiel talks about the exiles, they've been taken from Jerusalem and they are now in Babylon. And Ezekiel's the one that describes it. The glory of God leaves the temple and goes up to heaven, and there's no God in their midst. There's no glory in the Holy of Holies. It's gone. Ezekiel says, well, yes, but God told us he'll go with us to Babylon. So while he's sitting by the Kibar River in Babylon, Emmanuel, God is with us. And this is the promise that Isaiah is trying to drive home with his people, which is why when you come to 8, we have these very strange references to Emmanuel that almost nobody knows. What are they doing here? It doesn't make any sense. In fact, it seems like the exact opposite of what we should find. So you come to chapter 8, and it says, then the Lord said to me, take a large tablet and write on it in common characters, belonging to Mahar Shalal Hashbaz. So at the top, you just write, this tablet belongs to Mahar, and all those things. Okay? And I will get reliable witnesses, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah. And they'll come, because I'm going to write something on this about this name of what's going to happen. And here's what he's writing. I'm going to go in to the prophetess, who's his wife. And I'm going to have a child. And I could argue, like all child, are going to remind us of Emmanuel, because God is still keeping his promises. Israel is still having children. There is still hope for the child to come from them. That hope only ends when Israel's maidens stop having children. As long as they have children, guys, there is a hope that God will keep his promise and the seed will come. Now you start to see the connection with why Matthew can connect Jesus' birth to what's going on. So he says, I'm going to go into the prophetess and I'm going to have a child just to make the point that I believe God's promises will continue. Then the Lord said to me, call his name Mahar Shalal Hashbaz, which by the way means come quickly and plunder. In other words, it's like bring it on. That's what he basically named his son, bring it on, Tilgath-Pileser. And bring it on quick. Because your coming and the devastation that you will create cannot stop Emmanuel. The fact that God is with us. And before this boy knows how to cry, mother, my mother or my father. By the way, how old is the child when they know how to say mama or papa? Well, guys, it's not 4. It's about 1.5 years. So now he's saying, time is even shorter than the first one. The time is even shorter. Now it's only 1.5 years, maybe. Before he says mama or papa, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. You see what I think is going on though here? I think what he's saying is, guys, every child being born in Israel at that time was a sign to Ahaz, these guys will fail. They will be destroyed. And I know what you're thinking, Tom, you're ruining the significance of this prophecy. No, I'm not. You just have to wait with me. It's coming. But if you have to understand what Isaiah is saying in his context, I think what he's saying is every child reminds us that God has not given up on us, that his promises are still viable, that he is still with us. And by the way, every one of those children being born are just as much of a miracle as anything you can imagine. And they are a reminder that God's promises are being kept. And his child is a reminder. And so he says, before this will happen, they'll be gone. Now watch what he does next. Then the Lord spoke to me again. Because this people has refused the waters of Shiloah that flow gently. This is a gently flowing stream. Now it's a metaphor. Now what does it refer to? Well, I'm going to suggest it probably refers to the statutes of the law or something like that, being obedient to the Lord. Because they've refused to worship me and follow my statutes and live their lives, you know, on a nice float trip down the big hole river. Instead, they decided to get into a kayak and go down the middle fork of the Salmon. I've done that, and it was a nightmare. That's what he's going to say here. They have replaced the nice, gentle, flowing waters of Shiloah and rejoice over Rezin and the son of Remaliah. In other words, and they do. They follow, even though they hate these guys, they follow their worship practices. And therefore, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river, mighty and many, the king of Assyria and all his glory. This is not good. And it will rise over all its channels and go over its banks, and it will sweep up into the land of Judah. Oh no, he's coming for us. It will overflow and pass on, reaching even to our neck. This is terrible. And its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your whole land. He's going to destroy everything. Oh, Emmanuel. What? What the world is that word doing there? This is terrible. And then he ends it with, oh, Emmanuel. Exactly. It's going to get really bad. But thank God, Emmanuel. That's what he's saying. It's going to be worse than anything any of us can remember. It's going to be worse than when Ephraim was split from Judah. Guys, it's really going to get bad. And here's the real bad news. It's not going to go away. Because when this king is done with us, Nebuchadnezzar's coming. And when that king is done with us, the Persian kings are coming. And when those kings are done with us, Alexander the Great is coming. And when those kings are done with us, oh, we haven't seen anything yet. Because there are these things that you have never heard of called Caesars that are barbarians. Even though they think the Germans are barbarians, they are barbarians. And every one of these empires, they are going to wreck and pillage and kill and destroy and oppress and dominate. And we will be in a land of utter darkness. Oh, Emmanuel. But when you're in there, you got to remember every time a child is born to our people, God is with us. Every time. Every time a child is born, God is with us. His promises still hold. We still have hope that he will fulfill this promise. Read the next paragraph. Be broken, you peoples, and be shattered. Give ear, you far country, all you far countries. Strap on your armor and be shattered. Strap on your armor and be shattered. Take counsel together, but it will come to nothing. Speak a word, but it will not stand. For God is with us. Guys, we just decided to translate it there. I wish they would have just left it there. Left it. Oh, Emmanuel! That's what it is. Oh, Emmanuel. Yes, nations are coming, and they're gonna beat us to a pulp. And it's going to be for a long time. But God is still with us. In other words, what he's saying is, guys, they can take everything from us. They can even take our king off the throne. They can take our temple. They can take our cities and destroy them all. And they did. They destroyed every last city in Jerusalem, or in Judea and in Israel. They can take our people and throw them all over the world. But you know what they can't take? They can't take our God who is with us and his promises to us. They can't take those away. And every time we have a child, we know that promise is still viable and God is with us. Now, if we keep going, we will see, and it's very interesting at the end of this chapter, which we don't have time for, but at the end of this chapter, he now will go on and say, but why did God do this to us? Why has God allowed this to happen? I thought God would just keep us, you know, a nation there and a king on his throne and priests in the temple and us coming. And I mean, who saw this coming? So God explains it to them. Well, the reason why I did it is because you guys stopped listening to me. In fact, I made myself available to you. And instead of coming to me for counsel, you know what you did? You went and sought counsel from dead people. Necromancers. Sorcerers. You went and thought, instead of asking our God what I should do or where I should go and gain guidance from me, you went and sought that from dead people. You went and sought it from other gods that are not gods at all. In fact, read the end of this chapter. Over and over and over again, I gave you the greatest revelation in the world. You have a book in front of you that you can open up and seek my wisdom and seek my counsel and know what I want you to do. And you know what you guys did? You ran off to every other people, sacrificed your children, did everything you can to find out what Moloch wanted you to do or Astaroth wanted you to do or anybody else. And God said, I've had enough. I've had enough. If you're going to practice darkness, I will let you live in it. But this I will promise, Emmanuel. I will bring these people on you, and I'll strip you of all these things until you have nothing left but me. And then one day, and this is why chapter 8 ends with what? They're in utter darkness, and chapter 9 begins with what? Which is next week. Into this utter darkness, a light has dawned. And we learn that this light is a child. A light shines in this place of darkness. A new revelation of God that is greater than all the other revelations that came before. Okay, will you seek my will from this revelation? The greatest revelation I can send myself. And he will shine in the land of darkness. And he will restore. He will be a mighty God, an everlasting Father, a Prince of Peace, a wonderful Counselor. How about going to him for counsel? And the governments will be placed on his shoulders. I will reestablish what I promised, but it will be with this child. This is why Matthew can do what he does with the prophecy, because Isaiah does it. He says, guys, every one of these children remind us God is with us. And what are they reminding us of? That God keeps his promise. And what is his promise? I'm sending a son. I'm sending a seed who will bless the nations, who will rule you, who will sit on David's throne, who will bring about God's kingdom, who will teach you his law and write it on your hearts. And that son is Isaiah chapter 9. There is a son that is born, and we'll get there next week. Now we come back to Matthew. So what's Matthew doing? When Jesus is born, he recognizes it's the son of Isaiah 9. And he sees the connection with Isaiah 7. As every one of those children reminded Israel, everyone born to an Israelite maiden reminded Israel that God could keep his promises. This is the promise kept. And he is set apart. Because he is born to a virgin. a young maiden. But this time, with no help from anybody else. And why is that? Because he's not just a reminder of Emmanuel. He is Emmanuel. He is God with us. God has come down and taken on flesh. He is the mighty God, the everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, the wonderful Counselor of Isaiah 9. He is God himself in human form with his people. And the promise that Isaiah 7 gave us a sign that would be fulfilled, he fulfills it. So does Isaiah 7 point to Jesus and his virgin birth? Yes, it does. Just not necessarily in the way we thought it did. It points directly to the fact that Jesus is what we've all been waiting for. How about an application before we go sing a song? Guys, our world is actually much more like the world before the empires. But I think we're starting to figure it out. Things are changing. Right? Things are changing in our world. Guys, our country can go astray. It can lose its bearings. Just like Judah did, just like Israel did. But God is with us. In fact, I can count on it. I can also count on, I think there's an empire coming. I think as I look around this world, there's an empire on the horizon that's going to sweep up the nations of this world, and it's going to oppress the people of God everywhere. And we will have to remember every time we see a new person come to Christ, we will be reminded God keeps his promises. The gates of hell will not prevail against us. Emmanuel. God is with us. He is with us. Satan can take a lot from us. He can take all the things that we own. He can take a country, a government, and destroy it and put his own in its place. He can take family. He can take, you know, our educational system. I think he's already done that one. He can take all kinds of systems in our lives. But he can't take God from being with us. And so the very words of encouragement that Isaiah is giving to the people of his day, he could give it to us today. And he could say, I don't want to tell you how bad it's going to get, but it's going to get really bad. But I do have one piece of bright news for you. Oh, Emmanuel, and it will sustain you. And God will remind you in one miracle after another that you might have thought is just natural, that he is present in your life and he is with you and he keeps his promises. And nothing Satan do can thwart that. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for this passage and how challenging it is. I still have no idea if I'm even on track with it. But I do know this. I know that God being with us is what's important in that passage. You say it too many times for it not to be. And I know that I should read that passage and leave it and realize that in Jesus Christ and my relationship with him, God is with us. My God is with us. And he is with us always. And because he is with us, who can stand against us? No matter what happens to me, no matter what happens to your people, our God is with us. And his word will prove true, and his promises to us will be realized. And for this we thank and praise you in your name. Amen.